before we summarize the Night of Sense, I know that I said I would speak briefly about critical thresholds, and we had said here that someone had asked last night, well, what is an axial shift? And I think if we Google axial shift, we'll find all kinds of information. But before the axial shift happens, we come to a place of a critical threshold. And what is that threshold all about? In other words, it's a time that we may have, and we may not even know that we're there. We may not even know, except in retrospect, that we have gone through an axial shift. The truth is, we don't know much about anything except in retrospect. I mean, if I would ask you, well, 10 years ago, well, 20 years ago, and you would say, oh, yes, now I see, because we're here. And then I don't have that, the journey from believing to knowing, well, maybe our faith is here. Well, maybe our faith is here. Well, maybe our faith is here. So we are in the process of being transformed at every level. But sometimes this critical threshold comes at a place where we're on hold to perhaps think about where we are, and sometimes we don't even consciously knowing we're thinking about it. But a threshold marks the emergence, what is emerging, and asking for our continued consent at whatever stage of consent that we are. It marks the emergence of a new mode of being or becoming. What God ordains that we are becoming. Certain aspects of a previous mode may persist. In other words, there's no magic wand. Just as we said in these stages, you know, we bring who we are and our cultural conditioning here, and then this is sometimes corrected, and then we are asked to go through the same process, but we bring what is the leftover, so to speak, here. And one thing I want to say about this, and I know this is hard to understand, not having gone through the workshop, but it doesn't mean that we leave these stages or what we have been given here, which is the foundation of our spiritual journey, the foundation of everything that we are and what we have asked, why we have been asked to embrace faith in terms of understanding, acknowledging, and communing with that concept that we have called God, our Jesus, or the Christ. So, in other words, here, we may go back here, we may revisit here, but see it from an entirely new perspective with perhaps deeper appreciation, deeper acknowledgement, deeper respect, a deeper understanding of the reality behind all of the symbology and perhaps teachings. Does that make sense? Okay. So it doesn't mean that we abandon this or we abandon that or that kind of thing. A threshold is distinguishable from the stage which preceded it. The stage that follows is like a doorway to this new way of becoming. A threshold denotes a turning point which launches us into a new stage, perhaps, or deepens, I would use the word deepens, us in faith, hope, and love. And in terms of faith, if we are faithful to our prayer, prayer impacts faith, faith impacts prayer. The primary function of a threshold is to catapult a particular movement into that new mode of being or becoming. A given stage may comprise several phases, but each phase will indicate a further development within that same stage. In other words, there may be an initial stage, a settling in phase, and we talked about that here, where we may read books, we may meet people who speak to us, we may find a community that we resonate with. We become avid seekers in that stage. So that might be a settling in phase. And then we move maybe to a more advanced phase. The qualities of each critical threshold in our life is that it's radical, it's irreversible, and it's successive. A critical threshold dramatically will affect our roots, our attitudes, our values, our convictions. And all of this is applied to the spiritual journey. Does that make sense? Okay.
What is the second? It's radical, it's
irreversible. In other words, let's take Jesus the Christ. Jesus could not regress from his state of consciousness in which he made his incarnation. I mean, how could one do that? I mean, and that's might be a poor example, but how could one do that? We could not consent to continue the journey. That's weird. Okay. Or we could give permission, ourselves permission, just to move into apathy. Okay, that's good. Thank you. The vocation of the spiritual seeker, which is us, we're still seeking, is a universal call to holiness, our becoming whole. Our sanctification, and I like to think of sanctification as that we're evolving in consciousness, is not only for self. We tend to think, especially in those honeymoon days of the spiritual journey, that this spiritual journey is all about us. It's for ourself. I want to be better. I want to be good. I'd like to be transformed. I'd like to do the right thing. I'd like to have more faith. I'd like to be able to pray longer and better, whatever that means. But then we discover that it's not just for self. Wait, there's more. So it is true, too, that transformation of the human person, especially on a committed spiritual journey, involves multiple deaths, and it may take years. And I've often thought about going to Snow Mass on a 10-day retreat, and I said to someone, can't remember who, at one point in time, this was in the early years, oh, I'm going to Snow Mass on a 10-day retreat. This is going to be so exciting. It's going to be so uplifting. And the person said to me, oh, so you want to die? I thought, how rude, you know. I was telling them about this wonderful time I'm going to have. But I understand now. I have a little understanding that, in a sense, we do go into a 10-day immersion to give our life and to die to self. So our sanctification, or any bit of evolving consciousness that we may experience in this lifetime, is a gift for many and for the world. Our spirit strives to understand our faith experience so that we can more freely give ourselves to God's transforming and purifying love. John tells us, and of course we know from our experience to date, at this point in time, that the simultaneous ascent and descent, because you know we are ascending and yet descending simultaneously. And you can look at Thomas Keating's Spiral Staircase, where we are making a descent into the inmost, the deepest recesses of our being in the psychological unloading, but simultaneously we are ascending, making the ascent back to who and what we are in God and the dim realization of that. Maybe it's dim right now, and hope it will be get clearer as we move along. And we might have a touch of that, of realization. Death is the ultimate critical threshold, and if you've watched Father Thomas's series on the gift of life, and should be a contemplative act, the physical death, you know, and I don't see any teenagers here, so that applies to all of us in this room. It is the ultimate critical threshold and should be a contemplative act. Giving with unreserved abandonment of our whole self to God in faith. And here's where John's pure faith or absolute trust comes into play. Can I approach death with absolute faith, pure faith, and absolute trust and love? It is simply a movement yet to a new stage of life and consciousness. Okay, so in a nutshell, that kind of may help to explain what I'm talking about when we come to a critical threshold. Let's just summarize the three classical trials. And I'm just going to use the word certitude. The spirit of certitude, which impacts our exaggerated need for security, highlights our desire. We want to be certain of the spiritual journey. We need some kind of reward or payback. We need to know that what we're doing has value. It's going to take us someplace. Yes. Yes, you are right. Yes, yes, certainty. Certitude is what I want. Thank you, Maru. Incertitude, the spirit, so correct your notes if you were writing that down, the spirit of incertitude. We want to know. I want some kind of payback and reward. But God is weaning us to live by pure faith. The second trial, the spirit of blasphemy, which impacts our power center and lets us know that we are not in control even of our spiritual journey, because we want to desire events and situations in our life. One of the things about the night of sense is that a couple of people have said, well, I'm really glad that I've heard this, and I've read Thomas's book, and I've watched the tapes, and I'm so glad to know that when I enter the night of sense, if I do, I'm going to have a lot of information about it. And I don't say anything, of course. But I will tell you that there's something about the night of sense that is peculiar. And it is such that God renders us stupid about the night of sense or the night of spirit. And I know now because for our own good. And we can't intellectualize it. We can't analyze it like, oh, my gosh, am I in the night of sense? Oh, gee, I wonder how long this will last. And maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, but I'll get through this fine. It's not going to happen like this. And I know in my own life, I said, many years later, I should have known, I should have known, I should have known. But you don't know because God is silently at work. Many people will say, or some people have said, well, is this part of the will of God for you or for us? And what is the will of God for me? And I think in those early days of our honeymoon period, we spend a lot of time really wanting to align our will with the will of God. So if you've ever been a spiritual director, one of the critical questions that people will ask, maybe on the third or fourth visit, they'll finally come to the bottom line. What is God's will for me? Can you tell me what God's will is for me? Can you help me? And no one else can tell you what God's will is for you. The will of God is a silent faculty. There's no magic wand that one day you're going to wake up and you're going to hear a voice or you're going to have it in words, absolutely, what is God's will. In retrospect, would you agree that what you have done on the contemplative journey is God's will for you?
Yes.
We hope so. Me too. Okay. Getting back to the spirit of blasphemy. We cannot produce a cause and obtain a desired result because we don't know what's happening. We can rail at God for following up our plans for spiritual perfection. Someone told me early on, years ago, that in today's time, that one, if they are faithfully meditating, this was pre-centering prayer, pre-contemplative outreach, that one can come into the consciousness of Christ in 25 years. I thought, wow, I'll mark that on my calendar. Some of the crazy things we do on the spiritual journey. I can't remember the name of the person that told me that, but I also, later on, he was going to had to borrow money to take a course in levitation. And I often wonder if he ever learned how to levitate and if he's levitating these days. So there is a temptation, and Teresa is huge on this. When we experience this desert experience, this major purification, it is a temptation that we regard the trial as God is punishing us. We regress to perhaps early concepts of God as judge, as punisher, as judge and jury, as the police, as the boogeyman. And we fall back into this attitude that we are not worthy to be loved by God. No wonder I failed in the spiritual journey. God has his favorites, but I'm not one of them. Teresa said this is so detrimental to our spiritual journey, and I know that it is. Maybe I'll tell you my Tony DeMello story. Are you familiar with Anthony DeMello?
Awareness.
Pardon?
The name of this book is Awareness.
Yes, I know. Yes. Yes, well, I had the privilege of hearing him for maybe 5 years in a row. He would come to St. Louis and speak at St. Louis University after he left Fordham in New York, and he would make his way. And in retrospect, I had experienced a deep loss in my life, and I just needed to go there and hear someone. I didn't know anything about Anthony DeMello, but to hear someone who would say words that could give me some inspiration or healing on the spiritual journey. And so this was, I think, the last year he was ever there. The next year, in 1987, He died of a heart attack at Fordham University right before he came to St. Louis. So anyway, we would have an hour for lunch, and I just wanted to kind of be still and be alone, and I came back to the conference room, and I was sitting in maybe the second row, I think. And he was, Father DeMello was up on a platform, and he was a wonderful speaker, wonderful storyteller, and he would sing. He had a wonderful voice. Anyone else see him in person ever? Okay. And you know, what I noticed about him is that he would, in the very beginning, jerk kind of your belief system rug out from under you and leave you hanging. But then throughout the days, this would be a five-day event, you know, he would build on that. And with storytelling, and it was really beautiful. So I was waiting for it to reconvene and just kind of being and hanging out. And he came back to the platform, and he was arranging his papers for the next presentation. And behind me were some people from, some Indian people. He was, raised in India, and he had one parent that was, I think he was raised Roman Catholic. He was a Jesuit priest. So, but there were some people in Indian garb from India sitting behind me, and they were chatting. So at one point in time, he walked over to the rows where we were with the people behind me, and he stood right in front of me, and he never said a word, never looked at me, and he had this piece of paper, and he handed it over my head to the people in back of me. I don't remember hearing what he said to them, if he said anything, but what I heard interiorly, you are doing so much violence to yourself. That was it. That was it. And it seemed as though it was his voice. And he was right. I don't know if, I can't say, oh gosh, was it really, I take that with a grain of salt. I take any spiritual experience with a grain of salt. I think it was just a moment where I had to stop feeling sorry for myself. And yes, I was doing violence to myself and violence to the journey, but it was a moment of that gift, awareness. So however it came, whoever said it, it really, really began to free me. So things happened along the way. On the third trial, this spirit of fornication, which impacts our sensation center, that need inside of something we need to fill that vacuum, can be those temptations like Anthony. Thomas speaks of Anthony and his trials in the desert in Invitation to Love and on the Spiritual Journey video series. It arises from the desperate need to feel something or anything, especially try to recapture what we had in our honeymoon period. There are seven deadly attitudes that Sister Bernadette Teasdale put together years ago, and I asked her if I could use them because they were helpful to me. And she, in her presentation, she would say, and she called them, and this is kind of, deadly. That's a serious statement. Seven deadly attitudes. I might say something a little softer. But if we live out of these seven attitudes, I can see how it could be deadly to our spiritual journey. And in her opinion, the seven deadly attitudes are over-attachment, of course, aversions. And aversions mean I'm going to hold it out here. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know it. I don't want to deal with it. And if I'm told I'm in denial, so be it. Comparisons, expectations, anticipation, competition, and judgment will produce, with continued involvement in those attitudes, it will produce a state of dis-ease in our being, which equals suffering. Yes.
Would you mind going back to the last line?
To the last line?
Last line. The one before.
Oh. Okay, you'll have time if you want to take pictures. But remember that almost word for word, all this information is in your handout from these slides. Okay. So it said that the night of sense and the night of spirit is a wounding and yet a healing. So what is really happening at the psychological level in the divine therapy? The unloading of, and I would say the beginning of the unloading of unconscious material. Now, I want to address that word unconscious. When I was coordinator in St. Louis, the St. Louis chapter, I had the privilege, I think I was not coordinator yet, maybe I was certainly a volunteer, but one of my tasks was to visit prayer groups. And we had 22 prayer groups at that time, I think. And I loved visiting prayer groups. And if we were doing something for facilitators in prayer groups today, I would tell you about the time I visited a prayer group but ended up at a cocktail party instead. So we don't have time for me to tell that story, but it's a wonderful story. Anyway, but what I in networking with the facilitators, one thing I found in the groups that there was a lot of gray matter around that word unconscious, or that phrase unloading of the unconscious, or what the unconscious is. Is there still gray matter around that for you, for any of you? Sometimes there is for me. Okay, there's absolutely. Well, yes, I would let's just say right now we're talking about the night of sense and the emergence of that. Okay? We before we move to self-disclosure, we have to become aware of it. Okay. Let me just say this briefly, and I like to give this metaphor if anyone struggles with that term, because it's not frequently used. So if you've taken psychology, you know that we're making use of our conscious mind today in trying to understand all of this. And you know the subconscious is what we somewhat know that lurks below the conscious mind, and it's what we somewhat know and are somewhat willing to work with. But the unconscious lies beneath all of that. And in St. Louis, in the Midwest, we have basements. So I equate it with the basement of my house. Okay, I know what's on the second floor. I know what's on the main floor. But I'm not so sure what's in the basement anymore. Okay, so it's at that level. I have some kind of inkling, but I have no memory of it. So every once in a while, maybe in the spring and fall, I get very motivated, and I'm going to clean out that darn basement. And so I go to the basement door, and I open the door, and I flip on the light, and I take a couple of steps down to the basement, and I look around, and I think, well, maybe next fall. And so I switch off the light, and I go back upstairs, and I don't worry about it. Does that make sense? That's the best metaphor I can come up with to describe to sometimes facilitators in our facilitator formations what the unconscious is, because sometimes that happens in centering prayer groups. Certainly it happens within us. Okay, so if that is happening, and certainly will happen in the night of sense, a qualified spiritual director, a teacher, or a therapist may be helpful, or if it really gets serious, may be necessary. because our values are being changed. They're being challenged. What's real, what's not real. My view of God is changing in my relationship, or even right now, my non-relationship. But remember, we have, when we're asked to believe in this stage, we have childhood images of God. Many people, Jim Fowler, who has written volumes on faith development, said that in this stage that many of us carry through our whole life, the concepts of God that we assume are impressed upon us by family or peers or community as a child, and they never change. So we're being challenged in this, and perhaps that we're getting a new impression of God, but yet don't understand. So discipline and faithfulness to prayer will channel those energies from the unconscious if we can consent and just be still. So God is offering God's self to us at the level of where we are in terms of consciousness at that time. The gifts of the night of sin. So what's the outcome of all of this if we hang in there? It brings an end to the exaggerated emotional programs for happiness. Does it mean that we're free from all that? No. But it means that a lot has been healed in this process. And here we come back to your question, self-knowledge. Now we're seeing, you know, we're realizing some of these obstacles that we're still harboring. And the woundedness, revealing the extent of the harm that has been doing in our life and in our being by our false self value system and the stranglehold that it's had us in. Humility is the greatest fruit of the night of sense, because our self-centered motivation is revealed. Always, always, whatever we endeavor, whatever we're doing in life, whatever we're bringing to the spiritual journey, what is our motivation and hidden agendas? Someone once said to me, and I know that it's taken from an author, and I looked it up at one point in time, can't remember its source, but I love this and try and live by it. Seek nothing, refuse nothing. So security, power, and all of those dominant energy centers and its effect on us, and those emotional programs for happiness are no longer pursued as what I think is going to make me happy as substitutes for God, or what I think I need. So the energy of the Spirit opens those doors of higher consciousness, just understanding. And there's we can say one word for a state of consciousness, and that is understanding. I understand. What a gift. What a gift. Now, it not has translated to wisdom yet, because I have to live it in ordinary life before it morphs into a state of wisdom. So freedom from overdependence on communing with God and our relationship with God, unlimited trust, moving to that pure faith, our absolute faith, the experience of God leads to genuine compassion. What I love about the dismantling of the false self, the befriending of it, and you've heard me speak, some of you have heard me speak volumes about making friends with our false self and not holding it out here and looking at everyone else's false self, but allowing it to come here and letting it, befriending your false self, making it your best friend. And when we can do that, not fearing it, not fearing what we're going to see in that, because when we can do that, and we know it as our best friend, it becomes our greatest teacher on a daily basis. Okay. And it teaches us when we know that we are on that, here's a critical threshold of I'm moving into, I want to react from my previous false self value system because I want to feel justified. I want to feel satisfied. But I'm offered a window of opportunity. So do I want to continue to act out from false self? Or do I want to recognize that window of opportunity and step out in the advantage place of true self? Okay? And speaking of genuine compassion, I think if we can do that, the befriending, that process of befriending the false self, it cultivates compassion in us because we see that we're all in this together. We all have one false self, and we're all being healed. So I no longer look at others' false self and accuse and blame, but take ownership of my own. And this is a quote from Thomas, the interior silence releases an immense energy in service to others. Okay. So how do we stay sane? How do we retain some facsimile of sanity when we're going through these desert experiences? And Father Thomas says that, well, there are two banks of the river, and one is devotion and the other is service. And if we can give ourselves to that, and it takes a lot, it will take a lot, but it will prevent isolation and self-containment on the journey. And it will foster genuine trust and dependence on God. So, in conclusion, in summary, the three signs of the night of sense is the feeling of abandonment by God, feeling that we are regressing, and that we are possibly offensive to God. And we are challenged not only in the spiritual realm or our interior life, but in our external life. We feel incapacitated to pray. We have no lack of concentration. One of the benefits of our church community, our centering prayer community. I remember when I was coordinator, one of my four daughters ended up in intensive care in the burn unit. And I was definitely incapacitated to pray. But I depended on the prayers of my church community and my contemplative outreach community to do what I was unable to do. And the outcome was just amazing. So, and maybe the outcome wouldn't have been so amazing. But that's where that absolute trust and faith comes in. So we feel incapacitated in prayer. We may not have the lack of concentration. We sit down and we feel that we're just wasting time. And God certainly has lost interest in us. We're no saints. An invitation to love, Thomas outlines five significant fruits of the Spirit. Freedom for over-identification of spiritual roles, gifts, or charisms. Freedom from consistent domination of any emotion or emotional swings. I can tell you one thing, that life still happens. We still get angry, we still have emotions that arise, but it seems that it doesn't last nearly as long, and that we have tools and the love of God to really help us through that. Purification of our idea of God. Do we still see God as an old man with a long white beard and us sitting in white robes and us sitting on his lap as a child? I've met people who still view God. Is that wrong? No. Is it right? Probably not. But It's just where we are. But that may change. Purification of the traditional virtues of faith, hope, and love. Maybe perhaps personal views of religion, how we perceived it, how we interpreted it, of Jesus and even God himself may be shattered for a time. Increased desire to let go of the selfishness that still lingers, that deep-rooted selfishness. And eventually to become free of every obstacle to divine life. Okay? God is not bound by our ideas and expectations. There's a wonderful story, I wish I'd brought it with me, about the story of Lazarus. I can't remember it word by word, but anyway, Jesus was informed by the members of the house of Bethany that Lazarus was dying. And as close as Jesus was with the members of the house of Bethany and Lazarus, of course, they thought Jesus would come right away. He was off teaching. And he didn't come. And 3 or 4 days passed and Lazarus expired. And then Jesus said to his disciples, it's time to go. And we'll go to the house of Bethany. And they were surprised that when he came, you know, after Lazarus' death, after he had been entombed. But what was his perfect plan for Lazarus? Resurrection. So we have expectations of God, but God is not bound by our ideas or expectations. The night of sins may begin early on the spiritual journey. And I have seen that happen with people. the night of sense may be, and the night of spirit may be reversed, or may take place simultaneously. It's time for us to gather in small group, but just before we do, I want to ask you if there are any stuff around this, any questions, any comments, any insights that you have that you'd like to share.
If we continue our centering prayer practice, and, you know, I've read this information in the book and everything, I found myself becoming deeply concerned and analyzing where I'm at, you know, like that first question there. If we continue just on our, and it messes with my head, and I just want it to be simple. If I just center, will this all happen anyway? And this information then would almost be like consolation to us because we would understand what's happening.
Yes. Now, is this imperative information for us to know on our spiritual journey? No. No. Life is going to happen. One question I get sometimes, well, people who aren't on a committed spiritual journey, will they go through a night of sense? Yes. But we don't have the language to describe it. And it might be different. It might cultivate faith and trust. It may cultivate bitterness and anxiety and anger. So I've seen it go both ways. I think for many of us, it's helpful because we lead centering prayer groups. Many people in contemplative outreach are spiritual directors. And spiritual direction for someone on the contemplative journey is difficult. We don't even know where to go. And in Father Thomas's guideline is that seek out a spiritual director who has some working knowledge, hopefully a little experience, but some knowledge of the night of sense and night of spirit so that one can understand perhaps when a directee might be a person might be going through some of these trials. Does that answer your question? So we could live all of our life and love God and God love us without having ever come here today, of course. Okay. Okay, so Anyone else? Anything else? Yes, Paul.
When you were talking about befriending the false self, what a gift it is, I was thinking that that's one of the great gifts of the welcome prayer.
Yes.
Especially that stage of just staying with the hurtful or negative emotion. Just accept it.
Yes. Yes, and that is the outcome of the befriending process. It's kind of the how-to, one way of the how-to of entering into that friendship with the false self. And for some of you who have been to other workshops that I've done, you probably heard me say that when I came to Contemplative Outreach, and Nestor mentioned this morning that, yes, I had a meditation practice of 13 years before I came to Contemplative Outreach, but I never heard that term false self. There are other terms for it in other traditions, but when I came to Contemplative Outreach, I heard false self all over the place, and I just couldn't bear it, because after all, I came to Contemplative Outreach to grow in relationship with God, to feel blissful about my relationship to God, to get better, to enjoy the spiritual journey, to learn new things. But I was really getting tired of hearing all about this false self stuff. So for a good long time, I held it out here. And I watched the spiritual journey videos, and I would think, oh, wow, aren't they good? Boy, I wish my husband could hear this. He really needs to hear this. Now, I've never told him that, so don't you ever tell him I said that. But, you know, we have a tendency to think that the false self is for everybody else. But the day of reckoning came when I think I was serving a retreat with Marie Howard, and I know she won't mind me saying this, and for those of you who know Marie. And we were watching the Spiritual Journey videotapes with the retreatants, and we said, well, we'll take turns. You know, I'll watch one and you watch. And so we both watched the first one. And then I thought, wow, maybe I'll sit in on the second one. And so she did too. Then we sat in on the third one. Then we sat in on the fourth one. And the truth of it is, then we would have a little discussion in the evening. And I have to say that maybe it was the third or fourth time I've seen them. But in that moment, I stood convicted. And so did Marie. And we could honestly share the things that we didn't realize are here before that was impacting our personal life. And I began to see Thomas's jewel. I think the jewel of his teachings is the false self value system and the dismantling process, how he has helped us. And not just, I mean, there are many other teachers than Thomas Keating, how we have been helped and given the courage and perseverance in the dismantling process. Think of how many people leave this earth, this planet, and go through transition still accusing and blaming other people for their plight in life. Interesting. So it's wonderful. The false self is huge. Yes. Anything else about that? One thing, I know we have about 3 minutes before you go into your small group, because you have 30 minutes for that. I wanted to say something about faith. Because we said last night, we said this morning, that John is attempting to lead us on that journey of faith to pure faith. But I want to read just a couple of sentences from Jim Fowler's work on the six stages of faith. Anyone who has studied theology or eventually come across Jim Fowler, James Fowler, and he passed away last October, and he was an adjunct professor in theology in Emory University in Atlanta, and he was a former Methodist minister, but has done volumes of work on these six stages of faith. Now, the terms that he uses are sophisticated and intellectual, but I like to synthesize them to these three primary stages of prayer and faith. The first stage, he says, is the intuitive projective faith. That's the first stage, and he said it begins about the age of two, and it's marked by the emergence of language and physical mobility. The child has a lively imagination and an intuition which can penetrate beneath the surface of life, okay? So the child relates when he is asked to believe in that first stage, you know, this impression or what people are saying about God, the child uses their gift of imagination and fantasy to conjure up an image or an impression of God in their life. And of course, we have pictures and we have images and that kind of thing, which is a help to the child. Fairy tales, stories of religious traditions, and in my life, the stories of saints, as I said this morning, really stayed with me. So this stage lasts from about birth to 7 years. And the second stage would be what's called the mythic literal, Fowler's second stage. Again, a sophisticated term that says it begins about 6 or 7 years of age. And they have developed operational thinking. They can kind of think about things now. So fantasy and imagination become a little less important as the child begins to think in more of a orderly, linear manner. And, of course, still being taught about Jesus and Christianity and faith or whatever tradition they are in. So the individual is in what he calls an affiliative stage of faith. And faith becomes a matter of reliance on the stories, rules, and implicit values of the family's community of beliefs and meanings. Okay? So the third stage is the synthetic conventional stage. And it begins to emerge in adolescence and may last through one's adulthood. Now, the one thing about the synthetic conventional stage is that Jim Fowler says that the majority of people, humanity, remain at this third stage throughout their lifetime. Okay? So the person struggles to formulate a story of their story, and we may seek out various groups, family, school, church, peers, among others. We begin to look for like-minded people. We have a story by then, and it becomes a unique configuration. And we might even begin to listen to the beliefs of others. In the fourth stage, the individuative reflective stage may begin to arise at late adolescence at the earliest, but I haven't seen many people. But for many people, it does not begin until their mid-30s or mid-40s. And I think that's more the norm. There are always exceptions. And for other adults, it just never begins.
What was the name of that again, please?
Individuative, reflective. The individual begins to take personal responsibility for values, beliefs, and lifestyle. When people in their 30s and 40s begin to experience this process, their life structure may be quite disturbed. Okay? There is a beginning awareness of the paradoxes and polarities of life. More and more. So the fifth stage, let's just move through that. Conjunctive faith is the fifth stage. And usually begins in the 40s. This stage of faith emerges with midlife or beyond, involves the integration of elements in ourselves, in societies, and our experience of ultimate reality. It has contradictions, polarities, and at least paradoxical elements. Okay? The adult at this age is aware of being part of the bridge generation linking elders with the young. The transition to conjunctive faith is marked by certain characteristics, maybe becoming aware of polar tensions in life, challenges, polarities as old and young, masculine, female, constructive, destructive, conscious, and unconscious. To cherish paradox and the apparent contradictions of perspectives on truth as intrinsic to that truth. So, anyway, the universalizing faith is the sixth stage. And he says that this is rare, really rare. And at the same time, the adult is growing in a participation in the valuing of the Creator and is able to value the world from the standpoint of God's love for that world. And he also says that death becomes irrelevant at that stage. And I like to ask people when we do more of this in a different workshop, at what stage, who do you know in your life that has reach that sixth stage of universal faith?
Mother Teresa.
Who? Well, some would say Thomas Keating. Pope Francis.
John Paul II.
John Paul II. Your mother. Thank you for that.
We all thank you.
Well, because it's time for your small group, I'll just tell you, people say, and every group will say the same names. Pope Francis is very popular right now. Mother Teresa always gets high honors. Mahatma Gandhi. And some will say Thomas Keating. Some will say Richard Rohr. And so we name all of the spiritual celebrities. And then what I like to ask them, who in your life? Because so many people, saints, go unrecognized. And so, Maru, I appreciate you saying your mother. So I think there are people walking around with us in daily life, in ordinary life, in the workplace, that go unrecognized for who and what they are in God in this ordinary life. Okay. All right. In your small group, and you can stay at these tables if you want, you can get up, you can move to another table if you want, you can change chairs, whatever you want to do.